Hi everyone, this is episode 10 of the Metaphysics of Physics podcast. I am Ashna, your host and guide through the hallowed halls of the philosophy of science. Thanks for tuning in. With this show, we are fighting for a more rational world, mostly by looking through the lens of the philosophy of science. We raise awareness of issues within the philosophy of science and present alternative and rational approaches. You can find all the episodes, transcripts, and subscription options on the website at metaphysicsofphysics.com. Today we have with us James Valiant, a good friend of Duane and I, and author of the book Creating Christ. He is going to tell us about the thesis of his book and why it is so very important. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. This sounds like quite the claim to make. But I think before you get to the end of this interview or question-guided lecture, so to speak, you will see how it easily explains all the facts, including many otherwise mysterious and baffling aspects of Christian and Western history. But since he can explain it better than I can, let us start the interview. Welcome, James. It's great to have you on the show. Why don't we start with you explaining the basic idea behind your thesis?
Well, hello. My name is James Valiant. I'm the author of the new book, Creating Christ, How Roman Emperors Invented Christianity. Basically, it takes on what would certainly strike most people today, certainly most Christians today, as a rather outrageous thesis that, in fact, the New Testament is Roman propaganda, that when it was originally written, it was written with a certain political agenda, as well as a certain theological agenda. Most Christians, of course, would think that's crazy because they regard Christianity as the very opposite of Roman philosophy. The Romans persecuted Christianity, and Hollywood has certainly convinced them of that in the last century. But there's a forgotten history here. 2,000 years ago, there was a cataclysmic war between the Roman Empire and Jewish messianic rebels. And the rebellion was largely motivated by religious factors. And it was that war, that cataclysmic war, that destroyed the temple, for example, and reduced it to the Wailing Wall that it is today. It is difficult for me to imagine that Christianity emerging at that very same moment in history is just an accident. And when we started our research, we found really nothing to contradict our theory. And then we found some remarkable physical evidence, which basically demonstrated it. But in short, the thesis is that what we have in the New Testament is Roman propaganda, written 2,000 years ago to sort of quell the Jewish revolt. You know, that's the very much the 30,000-foot level of analysis, or I should say 10,000-meter level here. From New Zealand. So from way up in the sky looking down on it, the way to really look at it is that the moral idealism that we read in the New Testament, which is regarded as moral idealism both by Christians and even by secular people who've adopted it, is really a form of political propaganda. And by having forgotten the original context of the New Testament's creation, it's very easy to detach ourselves from that and think of the doctrine of Jesus Christ as sort of an unworldly, an unearthly form of moral idealism. But when you just change the angle slightly and you look at the entire New Testament from this new angle, suddenly everything is explained and everything is explicable. And we were simply blown away, I think, when we started pulling that string because nothing contradicted it and all the evidence seemed to confirm it.
Does it matter how Christianity got started, and why does it matter to us now?
Well, that's a fair question. This is 2,000-year-old history, and Christianity has certainly changed considerably in its, at least its operative doctrines. The New Testament obviously hasn't changed, but the way Christians understand and live those doctrines has dramatically changed over the last 2,000 years. So that's a very good question. Why should we even care? Well, there's two very good answers to that, right? History matters, and particularly the history of ideas. Human beings are really motivated by their ideas, and their history can be understood in terms of the power of ideas. And although these ideas are 2,000 years old, they still reach across the millennia and control our psychologies, our view of what's morally right and wrong. Even people who are secular, people who tend to be, say, on the left, political left, and who don't have much of a religion, have basically adopted Christian social ethics as their own. Socialists and communists basically have applied the ethics and the social doctrine of the New Testament in a very consistent way, in fact, while simply leaving out all the mystical, miraculous stuff. So the values and the ideas expressed in the New Testament are still a living, vital, powerful force. On the American left, they've adopted elements of pacifism, social altruism, concern for the poor above other considerations, and the discovery, whether you're religious or not, that the moral idealism of Christianity is in fact simply a form of political propaganda is important. I'm not saying that that every single thing in the New Testament is to be thrown out. I'm just saying that it needs to be reevaluated. Every single moral doctrine in the New Testament needs to be reevaluated in this light, rather than simply assumed as the moral ideal that it is and that is still controlling people today. It seems to me that it is at one level of analysis, it's important to understand that the New Testament isn't history. Scholars for the last 200 years have determined that the New Testament is not reliable history. But I think it's even far more powerful and far more important to identify what the New Testament actually is, to place it within its contemporary political and cultural context, like we do any other literature or doctrine. And once you do that, understanding what it is, I think, far more persuasive than simply saying it's not reliable. In other words, if Jesus tells you to turn the other cheek, is that really the best policy in light of the fact that it was written in order to pacify rebels 2,000 years ago? We can see the agenda behind saying turn the other cheek, or blessed are the peacemakers, et cetera, et cetera. But before we simply adopt that as our moral code, we need to understand the real motives behind the people that wrote those things.
Are there any modern parallels? And can we apply what happened then to anything happening now?
Oh, very much so. In fact, the same basic conflict that we are discussing in the book Creating Christ, that cataclysmic war between the Roman Empire and Jewish messianic zealots, is really still playing out in a way today. The entire religion of Islam can be traced to, I believe, to the extreme monotheistic zealots of the first century. The war between Rome and these, and basically the Jewish rebels, stratified Judaism of the first century into three surviving religions. The Judaism that survives today, Rabbinic Judaism, that greatly de-emphasized the entire concept of Messiah and therefore reduced the political threat that Judaism might represent to foreign governments as Jews were living in diaspora in various, as minorities in various other cultures, Christian or Islamic cultures. Christianity, which is a sort of the pro-Roman peaceful response to Jewish messianic activities in the first century. And then, of course, the Jewish rebels themselves, which never went away. And they simply transformed over the centuries into Islam. The Islamic terrorism of today is, in effect, the same conflict of 2,000 years ago. Western civilization, in effect, is still beating back a violent form of Eastern monotheism. In effect, we're fighting the same battle 2,000 years later. And the irony is that our response is very similar. Today, Western political leaders, for example, assure us that Islam means peace and that Islam commands peace and that jihad is an internal conflict, not an actual rebellion. And in so doing, they're doing, in effect, precisely what the Romans did in creating Christianity. They said Jewish messianic religion, in effect, is a pacifistic one. One that says, cooperate with political leaders, pay your taxes, and turn the other cheek.
What about Roman persecution? Didn't they feed Christians to the lions? If not, why do you think this is widely believed?
Well, the Roman Empire actually was a remarkably tolerant government when it came to foreign religions, comparatively speaking. They obviously did not have what we call freedom of religion or freedom of conscience in the West today. There was religious persecution because, remember, politics and religion were joined at the hip in those days. There were political implications to any religious idea, and there were religious implications to most political ideas. Nonetheless, the Romans tried to be as tolerant as to as many foreign cults and religions as they possibly could. And so persecution was actually not the norm within the Roman Empire. However, this Jewish war that I was referring to earlier was a major ideological challenge to the Romans. Jewish monotheism forbade them, for example, from participating in any kind of acknowledgement of Roman state deities, which the Romans thought just a perfunctory part of, you know, joining their empire, and which other polytheistic cultures had no problem doing. The Jews, with their strict form of monotheism, many of them found it difficult to participate in Roman society generally as a consequence. At first, the Romans tried to create exemptions for the Hebrews, exempting them from emperor worship or the public worship of Roman state deities, at least at first. But nonetheless, any connection with foreigners, any contact with foreigners, began to be regarded as pollution by the more extreme elements among the Hebrews. Simultaneously, the Romans began to see the Jews in various anti-Semitic ways, and a conflict became inevitable. There were continuous disturbances, outbreaks of rebellion and riots in Alexandria and Egypt and in Rome itself, until finally in 66, open rebellion broke out in Judea itself, climaxing in the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. Decades later, in the early second century, still a second Jewish war would break out. Now, those Jews who were leaders of this movement, religious and political leaders, rebel leaders, were obviously heavily persecuted by the Romans. The Romans crucified them in the thousands. They tortured them for information. The Romans were not Boy Scouts. They were ruthless conquerors. So there was a persecution, and indeed a persecution of Messianic Jews in the first two centuries. Christianity is an offshoot of Messianic Judaism and has sort of adopted that persecution as their own. Although what we call Christianity is an entirely different doctrine. In fact, in many ways, the very opposite doctrine of the Jewish rebels. They were messianic. They believed in the prophecies of the Old Testament that said a Messiah would come and liberate them at such times of foreign oppression. But Christianity has a strikingly different approach to the concept of Messiah and an altogether different approach to Jewish exceptionalism. Jesus seems to be opening up Judaism, which is a somewhat exclusive religion. It's not easy to convert to Judaism. For adult males, for example, it involves circumcision. And in the ancient world, of course, that made a conversion to Judaism very, very difficult and problematic. Christianity seems to be opening up the Jewish faith to the entire world. Circumcision didn't matter to Paul or to Jesus. A kosher diet didn't matter. A strict Sabbath observance. In other words, everything essentially distinctive to Judaism was basically turned on its head in the New Testament. In addition, they stressed a doctrine of peace with Rome. Paul himself declared the Roman Empire to be God's appointed agent on earth, no less, and rebellion to be a sin as a consequence. This doctrine is found in the Gospels as well. Jesus praises, for example, the faith of a non-Jewish centurion above that of, quote, any of the sons of Israel. Imagine today an American GI being praised by an Islamic cleric as having more faith than any Muslim. It would be that astonishing in our context. Jesus, of course, famously said, "Render unto Caesar." Jesus, of course, famously advocated peace with Rome. He went so far as to say, "Submit to the evildoer." So what we're seeing is sort of the concept of Messiah itself, which at the time in the first century was inherently politically charged one. The rallying cry of the Jewish rebels was Messiah. And the contemporary historians in the first and second centuries report perfectly plainly that it was these messianic prophecies that most motivated this cataclysmic Jewish war of the first two centuries. And so it's striking that what we see in the New Testament is a paradox. The concept of Messiah being sort of turned on its head. Here we have a peace-loving Messiah who praises centurions, advocates paying taxes, hangs out with tax collectors, sort of turning on its head the first century messianic doctrine of the rebels. And so this paradoxical combination of both the concept of Messiah along with the concept of a peacemaker and an advocate of peace with Rome, that very combination is unusually paradoxical. So with Christianity, what we see is sort of simultaneously, suddenly, and sweepingly, all of the most culturally alienating aspects of Judaism in the Mosaic Law, from circumcision to kosher diet, that made it difficult for Jews to assimilate within the Roman world, all being swept away at the same time. And we see the concept of Messiah transforming into sort of a pro-Roman, peace-loving Messiah, the very opposite of what Messiah had meant to Jews up to that point. And we see it all happening simultaneously in the wake of the first Jewish war. On the face of it, that strikes us as Roman propaganda, specifically designed and addressed to Jewish rebels of the period. So yes, there was Roman persecution, but Roman persecution of a very different kind of, let's say, Jewish Christian, whose doctrine was basically the opposite of the doctrine we read in the New Testament. Why would the Romans have persecuted a doctrine that advocated peace with Rome? Blessed are the peacemakers, submit to the evildoer, turn the other cheek, pay your taxes, render unto Caesar, the praise for the centurion. Why on earth would Romans persecute such a religion? They wouldn't. Obviously, the Romans would have had every interest to promote such a doctrine. And in fact, the evidence seems to suggest that they were actively promoting that very doctrine. And that's how Christianity got its start. Now, as time went on in the Roman Empire and Christianity became a very popular religion, it began to compete with other also monotheistic cults, the cult of Sol Invictus or the cult of Mithras. And both of those tended also to be monotheistic and therefore mutually exclusive. And when that began to happen, and when would-be Roman emperors were taking sides in such matters, yes, there was some limited persecution of what we would call Pauline Christians or New Testament Christians, but that was at a much later date and for very limited periods of time. But so pro-Roman and so Roman-friendly was the New Testament that it eventually took over the Roman Empire. In a very easy and friendly way, Roman emperors became Christians. The doctrine is enormously pro-Roman. It no less than four occasions, the New Testament commands slaves to obey their masters, even harsh ones, even when the masters aren't looking. The emperor is to be honored. We're repeatedly told to obey authority. The outsized praise repeatedly heaped on Roman officials and Roman centurions in the New Testament is noteworthy. And part of the reason why Christians have this false notion of persecution is Hollywood. After 2,000 years of anti-Semitism, let's face it, Hollywood cannot present the greatest story ever told, the story of Jesus as it is told in the Gospels. Mel Gibson tried to do that with his movie, I think 15 or so years ago, called The Passion of Christ. And there he followed the Bible very, very carefully. And of course, he was met from all quarters with accusations of anti-Semitism. And Mel Gibson, of course, responded, "Well, I was just following the gospel story." And of course, the gospel, he was. That doesn't excuse him of the charge of anti-Semitism, but it does sort of underline the fact that Christians are sort of in deep denial. For, the last 2,000 years, passion play performances would stimulate Christian mob violence against Jews. The story of the narrative behind the death of Jesus, really, as told in the Gospels, can only be seen one way. In a rather racist way, the Jews, as such, are being blamed for the death of Jesus. So modern retellings of the story have cleaned that up, and they've taken that out, and they've made the Romans, in effect, the heavies in the story of the death of Jesus, which is not the obvious intention, original intention of the New Testament. So modern Christianity is in denial about those aspects of the New Testament. And so every retelling that movies give us these days is sort of cleaned up, with all the original politics sort of removed as much as possible. And in fact, reversing the bad guys altogether from the rather racist way the Jews are blamed in the New Testament to blaming the Romans. Maybe I can take you through the passion narrative and explain how that's obvious. The famous story of Jesus, of course, is that his rhetorical foils in the Bible, the people he's arguing with all the time, are not Romans, of course, but they're Jewish authorities of various stripes, Pharisees, scribes, Sadducees. They catch him his disciples working on the Sabbath. Why do you let your disciples violate Mosaic law like that, Jesus? And that's when he says the famous line, well, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And these kind of rhetorical jousts with Jewish authorities go on and on until finally Jesus enters Jerusalem and morally and physically attacks the temple. He says, you've turned it into a den of thieves. Interestingly, he adds, it should be a house of prayer for all nations. Again, sort of stomping on Jewish exceptionalism. This attack, of course, upsets the priesthood. They get Judas, one of Jesus' own disciples, to betray him. Judas betrays him with a kiss, famously. Jesus is tried before the Jewish council, the Sanhedrin, charged with offenses against the Jewish Mosaic law, and convicted of them in a sort of kangaroo court proceeding. They take him to Pilate, the Roman governor at the time. Pilate, hearing these religious charges, can't understand them. In all four of our Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Pilate, the Roman governor, flatly declares Jesus to be innocent. He will not crucify Jesus. We're told that there's a Jewish crowd that's gathered. The Jewish crowd three times demands Jesus' death, sort of an artificial three times, crucify him. And only after three times this specifically named Jewish crowd demands Jesus' crucifixion does Pilate finally relent. And in almost what was a political cartoon at the time, he melodramatically washes his hands in a basin of any guilt. We don't need Matthew's version to add the Jewish crowd apparently in unison saying, his blood is on us and on our children. We don't need that line to know what all four Gospels are saying. The Romans would not have killed this tax-paying peace advocate. It was only the demands of this crazy Jewish crowd in a sort of very artificial story, in an obviously fictional or artificial story, it's pointedly blaming the Jews for the death of Jesus. And that has stimulated 2,000 years of Christian anti-Semitism. Christian anti-Semitism is no accident. No accident whatever. And there's no doubt that in the 20th and 21st centuries, Christian guilt over that anti-Semitism, which climaxed in the Holocaust, of course, the slaughter of millions of Jews just for being Jewish, has caused Christianity to sort of rewrite the text. It began much earlier than the Holocaust, sort of getting back in touch allegedly with its Jewish roots was actually part of the Reformation. So goes all the way back to the 16th century, this attempt to sort of reform Christianity and get back to basics. But even the early Protestants in the 16th century, men like Martin Luther, were vicious anti-Semites who clearly believed that the Jews were the ones responsible for killing Jesus. And so what we see is in the New Testament, there's very little question in my mind that there's, you have to ask yourself, who would want to exonerate the Roman government but the Roman government? Who, in the wake of the Jewish war, would want to so pointedly blame the Jewish people as a people for the death of their own Messiah but the Roman government? And who would need such an elaborate justification for what they did but the Romans? And Christians, the very first Christians to discuss this, the early church fathers, saw it in just that way. The Jews lost their war with the Romans and their temple was destroyed precisely because they killed Jesus. That's how Origen, the Christian writer in the third century, saw it. That's how Eusebius, the first Christian historian in the fourth century, saw it. The Jews got what they deserved because they killed Jesus. That was the common understanding by Christians until recent times, in fact. But Hollywood has had to clean all of that up and has allowed Christians, in effect, to maintain their deep, what I can only regard as deep denial about the inherent anti-Semitism in the New Testament. Combined with what appears to be obvious Roman propaganda in the doctrines of Jesus, it becomes a viable hypothesis that the Romans created the New Testament in order to pacify and quell these messianic rebellious Jews of the first and second centuries. And it's that persecution that Christians are sort of adopting as their own, if that makes sense.
What historical evidence suggests that they were not persecuted?
Well, I'd really refer readers to an outstanding book of recent scholarship. Professor Candida Moss, a British professor of theology, has done excellent work in her book, The Myth of Persecution, which discusses the alleged persecution of Christians at the hands of Romans during the imperial period. And she shows rather conclusively that while there was some limited persecution here and there, basically it's been dramatically overstated by Christians. There's very little evidence to actually substantiate the notion that New Testament Christians were persecuted. In fact, early Christian writers like Tertullian even tell us that Roman governors worked hard to get Christians off when people would try and inform on them. The Romans, through the imperial period, I would note and add to Professor Moss's analysis, I would simply add that there was a confusion by the Romans as to what Christians were. Were they these rebellious Jewish type of Christians, or were they these peace advocate Pauline New Testament Christians? And that confusion did lead Roman government authorities sometimes to be confused as to whether or not to simply persecute someone because they claimed to be a Messianic Jew, or whether they should do further analysis. But there's really no hard evidence of any sustained persecution. It wasn't until the middle of the third century that the Roman government passed any laws on the subject of Christianity, and those laws were only temporarily enforced and briefly enforced. So the whole idea of Christian persecution and being fed to the lions is a completely distorted one. Perhaps the most famous case of Roman persecution of Christians comes from the first century, where we're told that the notorious Roman Emperor Nero blamed Christians for the Great Fire of Rome in 64, the year 64 of the Common Era. There was a terrible fire which destroyed most of the city of ancient Rome in the year 64. And Tacitus, the second century Roman historian, gives us a detailed account of it. And we are told by him that Nero fastened the blame. Tacitus implies, of course, that Nero was the incendiary arsonist. And there's very little, many modern historians have questioned Tacitus's assumption here. Romans themselves did not like the Roman Emperor Nero and blamed him for many, many things that may not have been his fault. Not that he was a good emperor. He was a vicious and monstrous tyrant, but he was probably not responsible for burning his own capital to the ground. It cost him great expense and political problems and political headaches that he could have avoided had he not burnt his own capital to the ground. So many historians question whether Nero would have done that at all. But at least the second century Roman historian Tacitus reports that Nero blamed the Christiani. Let's think about that for a second. In the year 64, would the peace-loving Christians, the peace-advocating Christians of the New Testament, have made a plausible scapegoat? Or isn't it much more likely that the Christiani, or the Messianic Jews that Tacitus is referring to, are the Jewish rebels? For the fire happened in 64, and the Jewish war would break out just 2 years later in 66. We have other instances where we know Jewish rebels were arsonists and set fire in other cities like Antioch, and they were violent rebels who engaged in such terrorist activity. Let me ask a further question. Would there be enough of our Pauline Christians a mere 30 years or so after the crucifixion in the city of Rome to have made a plausible scapegoat for Nero? I doubt it. However, the Jewish rebels who had already started causing disturbances, even in the city of Rome as early as the year 50, would have made a very, very convenient scapegoat for Nero. In fact, let me go so far as to say they make a more plausible perpetrator for the fire. We have some evidence that the fire was arson. Tacitus reports that the fire would restart in various parts of the city despite efforts to put it out, and that the fires would start around the home of the notorious agent of Nero, Tigellinus. Again, I doubt Nero would have started the fires around one of his agent's own homes, but terrorists who were anti-Roman might well have done that. So let me suggest that, again, it's what's happening is that Christians have adopted persecution of Jewish messianics who Romans confused with Christians all the time, and adopted that persecution by Nero as their own. It seems hardly likely to me that whatever few Pauline Christians there were in Rome at the time could have made a plausible scapegoat. Besides, they were peace lovers, pro-Roman, pro-tax-paying peace lovers. Why would Nero have done it at all?
To what extent do you think the New Testament is responsible for anti-Semitism today?
Oh, I think there's very little question that the New Testament is the source of Christian anti-Semitism for the last 2,000 years. There are related secondary causal issues that come from that. But you know, it's like discussing the various causes. Say a historian will say, what were the causes of the American Civil War? And they'll discuss various things like, well, there's westward expansion, the railroad, the tariff. But really, it all redounds to slavery, doesn't it? And the same is true for Christianity. For example, Christianity forbids Christians from charging interest on loans. And it was only until recent centuries that Christians could do that. And on the other hand, Jews could charge interest on loans. This, of course, created a great deal of resentment in Christian culture about the alleged greedy Jew, you know. And it creates the sort of Shylock image from The Merchant of Venice, right? Demanding his pound of flesh. But really, all those are secondary issues. And there's other forms of anti-Semitism. Islam, for example, has a deep and profound anti-Semitism, which has little to do with Christianity. But in my mind, Western, European, and American anti-Semitism is grounded and rooted completely in the New Testament. The passion narratives I just described, the complete turning on its head of the Mosaic Law. As Christian literature itself develops, it grows increasingly more and more anti-Semitic. As I say, Christian writers begin to blame Jesus more, the Jews more and more and more for the crucifixion of Jesus, until it finally you see the Passion play reconstructions during the Middle Ages would simply cause mob violence. The Christians would watch these Passion play narratives around Easter time, and they would get so emotional they would literally become a mob with pitchforks and torches, and they'd go beat up and kill the local Jews. It really reduces to the fact that and has its origins in the fact that the New Testament itself is perfectly anti-Semitic. People have a hard time with that thought because they say, well, wasn't Jesus himself Jewish? Wasn't Jesus himself the fulfillment of Hebrew prophecies? It's very interesting to note that the New Testament takes great pains to condemn that specific generation of Hebrews, takes great pains to open up Judaism to all the world, and to stress the fact that the Hebrews themselves have somehow gone astray. And given that emphasis in the New Testament, the Jews in general, have been sort of segmented off in the Christian mind as particularly worthy of contempt. And that has its roots all the way back in that passion narrative. There didn't seem to be a Jewish group that Jesus didn't criticize in the New Testament. And even in the New Testament, St. Paul's enemies in the book of Acts, for example, or in his epistles, are clearly not the Romans. The Romans seem to be protecting Paul at every moment. His enemies, according to the story at least told in the New Testament, are Jews of various stripes, who are constantly pursuing him and attempting to have him killed or arrested. In the New Testament itself, the Jews are the heavies, not just in the story of Jesus, but in the story of Paul, in the martyrdom of St. Stephen, and over and over again. The disciples themselves are portrayed as dolts who don't understand the message over and over. Peter denies him 3 times. Judas betrays him unto death. Thomas doubts the resurrection and needs to touch the resurrected body. So they're doubters, deniers, betrayers. They don't get it. They're basically dolts who don't. The portrait of the disciples is particularly unflattering in the New Testament. And the portrait of Jewish authorities is even less flattering. It's really hard to escape the fact, if you're a fair reader of the New Testament, that it is systematically critical of first century Jews and their purity laws, their culture, their commitment to the Mosaic Law, their politics, their political zealotry, their violence, are all being specifically addressed in the New Testament and turned on its head from the Roman perspective. So it's what we're seeing here is the grounds, if you will, for 2,000 years of anti-Semitism. It was certainly Martin Luther's grounds for anti-Semitism. It was Eusebius's and St. Augustine's. Christians of various stripes, Eastern Orthodox, Western Catholic, Protestant, you name it.
All right, so if Paul was pro-Roman, perhaps even working for the Romans, why would they execute him?
Well, the first thing to note is that the execution of Paul, as reported in Christian tradition, is strictly speaking not to be found in first century Christian literature at all. When you read the Acts of the Apostles, which tells us the story of Paul, it cuts off before Paul actually even arrives in Rome, where he's allegedly executed. Now, I have no grounds to doubt that tradition, but it actually stems from a later oral tradition. There's one of the Pauline epistles, which was not actually written by Paul, in which Paul says, "I'm on my way to my death," which sort of suggests by itself that it wasn't written by Paul, but it sort of anticipates the martyrdom of Paul. But to back up and give you the real answer, many, many, many double agents in the history of espionage have faced that very fate, haven't they? As someone who works as a mole, which is precisely what Paul was trying to do, infiltrate, doing a very dangerous psyops sort of espionage operation for the Romans, he had to assume the identity of one of these Christian rebels and infiltrate their movement, either sincerely at one time be, or at least pretend to be for a time, a member of that group, and then start undermining it from within, which is precisely what he did. And when he started to undermine the what we might call the Jewish Christian movement, calling for, and this is really what Paul's great change to the Jewish Christian movement was, he turned it into a pro-Roman, pro-peace movement, actually one of the oldest sections of the New Testament. And there he names the Roman government as God's appointed agents on earth and says rebellion is a sin in consequence. And that is why we have to obey the Roman state and even honor the emperor. It's going well beyond any effort to simply appease the Romans or not rock the boat, right? He's saying the Roman government are God's agents on earth. The other thing that he's doing is, of course, altering the Mosaic law, turning it completely on its head. We know that the rebels, of course, as would be consistent with their ideology, were Torah Orthodox. It was those very elements, the Mosaic law, that they were fighting for. It was the practice of those very aspects of their religion that they thought required their political independence. And so in changing, say, circumcision, the requirement for circumcision, and Paul says it's absolutely no longer necessary, and that's, of course, why it's totally optional for Christians. Paul also says that kosher diet is no longer necessary. You can eat, you know, lobster and pork and et cetera, and you eat with Gentiles, and that's no problem. And so, of course, the very people that he was trying to influence in these ways reacted very violently. The Jewish Christian movement, which he had infiltrated, believed very, very differently on those subjects. And so I believe that the basic portrait that we get in the book of Acts, that various Jewish groups began to violently react negatively to Paul, rather than pacifying the Jewish Christian rebel movement, Paul was having the opposite effect. He was aggravating them. In his own letters, which are first-person letters that he himself writes, he says that he had open confrontations with previous Christians over things like kosher diet and circumcision, as anyone can read in Galatians. He outright damns the previous apostles like James and Peter. People don't realize that in the book of Galatians, the saints are arguing ferociously with one another. St. Paul is having a heated argument with all the previous Christians over these very issues. And he says he had to confront Cephas or Peter to his face over the issue. So we have a good indication that the Christians, I put that in quotes, who were prior to Paul were Torah Orthodox and violent rebels probably. And that makes perfect sense too, doesn't it? They would be the messianic ones, wouldn't they? In any event, Paul's infiltration of this movement, attempt to pacify it, attempting to soften its commitment to the Mosaic law itself, had precisely the opposite effect that it was intended to have. And as we can read in Paul's letter to the Galatians and in the book of Acts, and that those that violent conflict that it caused created the disturbances so heated that Paul was actually, his trial was transferred to Rome. And Paul, of course, as a Roman citizen, interestingly, demanded that his trial be transferred from Judea to Rome. And it's on his way to trial in Rome that the biblical story actually cuts off. Biblical tradition says that at some point later, he was martyred. Now, he arrives in Rome, very interestingly, on the eve of the Great Fire of Rome in 64. And if we can see the Great Fire, if the Great Fire of Rome really was blamed on Messianic Jews, then we can see Paul may have had a very counterproductive impact. He might have brought the violence that he had stimulated in Judea to Rome itself. In the wake of the Great Fire, he might have, Nero might have seen that he had become actually counterproductive to his purposes, and the execution of Paul might have been seen as a way of appeasing the violent Jewish crowd. And so Paul could have faced the fate that many, many double agents in the history of espionage face, right? Being killed by one side or the other. He had certainly become very inconvenient to the Romans by that point. His mission had sort of backfired.
You will like this next question.
I like them all so far.
Do you agree with those who think Christianity has roots in pagan mystery cults and other Eastern cults?
Well, there is a question I really do like, and it is a mighty topic. You know, what Creating Christ attempts to do is it attempts to integrate various and very disparate fields of biblical scholarship. And we definitely try and integrate the work of critical biblical scholars, but we also try and integrate the work of various other fields, such as those scholars who do see the pagan parallels in Christianity. And in this respect, it's very helpful, I think, to contrast it with its mother faith, Judaism. Judaism is a strict form of monotheism. As we recall from the Ten Commandments itself, the Lord thy God is a jealous God and will have no other gods before him. And the Ten Commandments also forbids the worship of idols, no graven images, no physical representations of God at all. Therefore, within Judaism, while they have a tradition of a Messiah, a prophetic savior who would come to rescue the Jewish people in times of crisis sent by God, he would be a mortal Messiah. Never in Jewish prophecy is it implied that the Messiah would be a God himself, the Son of God, or any such thing. They had messiahs in the history of the ancient history of the Hebrew people on multiple occasions. Moses and Joshua, who led the children of Israel into the promised land, could be seen as the first. But surely King David, who defeated the Philistines, right, and became the second king of Israel, was a Messiah. And then, of course, later, we're celebrating Hanukkah even as we speak. We're in the second day of Hanukkah. And Hanukkah celebrates the second century BC successful Jewish messianic revolt of the Maccabees. The Hasmonean Revolt, led by Judas Maccabeus, successfully led the Hebrews to independence over their Syrian overlords. So there had been repeated messiahs who'd come to the rescue of Jews, maybe even with miraculous help, with God's help. But the messiahs themselves were all men, perfectly mortal beings. What we have in the New Testament for the first time is a divine Jewish messiah, a God-man. And of course, the reaction by mainline Jews is precisely what you'd expect it to be. The very first references to Jesus in the Talmud ridicule his virgin birth, ridicule his claims to divinity, ridicule this very aspect of him, if you will. And so what's very striking is what Christianity does to the concept of Messiah. It turns him into a man-god, which is totally alien to, and in fact counter to, Jewish monotheism. The creation of this Jesus man God actually will create a problem within Christianity because it'll still claim to be monotheistic. And so it'll have to work that out with the concept of the Trinity, right? The Father, Son, the three aspects of God, right? Because it's really violating a basic tenet of monotheism in having a divine Messiah. And when we look at this divine man, God, Messiah, he has many features of pagan demigods and man gods. And their examples are just so numerous, too numerous to really to mention. Hercules, Heracles from Greek and Roman myth is a good one, or the healing god Asclepius, or the Persian god Mithra, which became Mithras, all of them, the Egyptian god Osiris, who became Serapis in a sort of a syncretized form, and maybe I should explain that. In the ancient world, pagan polytheism, after the conquests of Alexander the Great in the 4th century BC, sort of went into a period where it began to cross-identify polytheistic gods with one another. And so Egyptian gods were beginning to be cross-identified with Greek gods and so forth. And in this process of unifying gods, seeing all the solar deities as the same, we're seeing all the sky deities as the same, an increased cross-referencing of deities is going on in the pre-Christian pagan world. Moreover, there in the pre-Christian pagan world, something else is happening to religion. Instead of being focused on, say, political concerns, personal salvation in the afterlife becomes more and more of a concern within these pagan mystery cults. And soon you began to see what are known perhaps misleadingly as Orphic mystery cults, where the health of your loved ones or their happy afterlife is what's being sought with this secret knowledge of the demigod that's being worshipped. And there's a pattern to these pagan mystery cults as well. There's usually a god who is at first born of a god and a mortal female, such as, say, the healer god Asclepius of the Greeks. He was born of Apollo and a mortal woman, and he was a healer. And he became so good at healing the ill that he could actually resurrect the dead. And numerous heroes from Greek mythology are resurrected, we're told, by the healer god Asclepius. But of course, this vexed the gods of the underworld didn't like that this healer was stealing the souls of Hades from the underworld. And so Zeus kills Asclepius, who suffers a martyrdom as a result of his resurrecting activities. Well, Apollo, his own divine father, is vexed by that. And he says, well, Zeus, can't we do something about this? And Zeus says, well, let's turn Asclepius into a god, and that'll satisfy everyone. And so Asclepius, the semi-divine healer who was resurrecting people and martyred, enjoys his own apotheosis to become a god himself. And so the devotees of the cult of Asclepius would worship Asclepius both for his powers to heal the sick and to assure them of a happy afterlife. We can see this on numerous inscriptions. That very pattern should strike any Christian as obviously quite familiar. That's the outline of Jesus's own life, right? As told in the New Testament. And that's not the only one. There are numerous, many, 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 many parallels to various pagan mystery cult gods. And many scholars have gone over this in great detail. Jesus, the mere fact, for example, we're approaching Christmas, the mere fact that we celebrate the birth of Jesus around the winter solstice is not accidental. Jesus is portrayed in many ways as a solar deity, which many of these mystery gods were, such as Apollo, the father of Asclepius. He was the sun god. And when Asclepius becomes combined with the solar and afterlife deities of Egypt, Osiris, he takes on a new form, Serapis, which is sort of a afterlife healing god, which combines the features of Asclepius with Osiris, the Egyptian god of the underworld. And in the process creates a god that is actually represented both as Jesus is with a benevolent bearded Jesus-like aspect, but also as the beardless solar deity with a halo and rays coming out of his head. This god, of course, had his birth at the winter solstice like most solar deities did. The sun is metaphorically born, if you will. The old sun of the year, right, dies, and the new sun is born on the longest night and the shortest day of the year, the winter solstice, which we're right at now. And so solar deities in the ancient world traditionally celebrated their births at the end of the year, around the winter solstice. Interestingly, the Roman Emperor Titus celebrated it at around the same time as well. And so just the mere fact that Christians in their tradition celebrate Christmas at around this time is a very pagan element. December 25th is exactly when the Romans celebrated the birth of Sol Invictus, the solar god. there are many, many other aspects. The book, in the Gospels themselves, for example, in Matthew's nativity story, there are magi, that is to say, Zoroastrian, not Jewish, but Zoroastrian priests who've read the stars and determined that this is the world ruler who's just been born. Or take the resurrection of Jesus. Jesus is resurrected in all four Gospels at dawn. You see, like the sun rises, like the sun is resurrected. And in fact, the Gospel of John gives Jesus the title of the sun god, the light of the world. And in many, many other ways, Jesus resembles a pagan mystery god. The fact that he's divine is itself an affront to traditional Judaism. Just to turn the Jewish Messiah into this sort of demigod, this healer god, is a very pagan notion in itself. Yes, I very much believe that Christianity sort of completes the syncretizing, unifying movement that was happening among these pagan deities. We begin to see gods being, you know, turned into a sort of a pantheistic single being, these syncretized beings. Asclepius and Zeus are being combined with Osiris to become Serapis. And that sort of evolution continues through. And what we see in Jesus is the Hebrew Messiah being added into the mix. Jesus is I hate to use it, it's not a very friendly metaphor, but Jesus is sort of a Frankenstein's monster of elements, sewn together distinctly and even anti-Jewish elements, like being a man god or being born of a virgin or performing healing miracles, all of which are very common for pagan deities, but of course are direct affronts to Jewish monotheism and their conception of the Messiah. We see all kinds of other pagan Greek and Roman elements being fused in. Many, many, many scholars of Christianity, for example, have clearly observed the Platonic dualism that characterizes Jesus's message. Jesus says, don't store up your treasures here on earth where moths and rust can get at them. Store your treasures in the kingdom of heaven where they last eternally and imperishably. Well, what is that but a Platonic dissing of the material world, a Platonic elevation of this transcendent other world. And in the process, what they do is they use Platonic dualism, sort of, what does Jesus say? My kingdom is not of this earth. In the very process, they're taking the very political ambitions of the Hebrew people and their concept of Messiah and simply taking it away from this world and putting the Messiah in some supernatural dimension. The Platonic world of forms, this perfect order that has nothing to do with the world here, separating out the Messiah into some sort of unearthly thing, not a political thing, not an earthly thing at all. And in various other ways, we see Platonism and Stoicism sort of being layered in to the philosophy of Judaism. The very ideas that the Jewish rebels, the Jewish messianic rebels of the first two centuries were fighting, Hellenism and Platonism and Neoplatonism and Stoicism, we see echoed in the New Testament. So many echoes of classical philosophy are there in the New Testament that early Christians actually forged a correspondence between Paul and the Stoic Roman philosopher Seneca the Younger. The ideas of Seneca, the first century Roman philosopher, and St. Paul are so similar and have so many echoes that the Christians simply couldn't believe that the two men who would have been contemporaries could not have been in correspondence with one another. And so by the 5th century, the 4th century, Christians had forged a correspondence between, a fictional correspondence, between the Roman philosopher Seneca and the earliest Christian writer, St. Paul. So I'm very much of the belief that, yeah, both Hellenistic and Roman philosophy, as well as Hellenistic and paganistic religion, are grafted onto the Jewish Messiah to create this man god, Jesus Christ, in the New Testament. Jesus is a synthesis, a grand synthesis of just about every aspect of ancient religion that the Romans were aware of. And that's part of its power. Let's face it, Platonic and Neoplatonic philosophy was always far more consistent with Jewish monotheism than it was with polytheism. By the time you get to the Neoplatonics like Plotinus, we're talking about the form of the good being the one, right? It's just begging for a unified God, for a monotheistic God, rather than a polytheistic hodgepodge. And in this way, the developing Neoplatonic tendency toward monotheism perfectly dovetailed with Judaism. And that made Christianity, which was trying to both combine Neoplatonic philosophy, pagan religious elements, along with this Jewish Messiah, it made, and then it had all of this Roman political propaganda put into it, it made it the perfect vehicle for Roman state religion. Irresistible. It took over the Roman Empire and took over Western history since. So effective a formula was it at pacifying everyone, in effect, getting them all in line on the same religious page and getting them all obedient to the state. And it proved very effective. I mean, Romans 13, which declares the government to be God's appointed agents on earth, was used by Christian governments well into the 17th century and 18th centuries. Louis XIV's divine right, you know, l'état c'est moi, right? I am God's appointed agent on earth. Or the arguments of the British Tories against the American Revolution. The supporters of King George cited Romans 13. Look, you American revolutionaries, you're rebelling. And George III was a pussycat compared to Caligula and Nero. And not only that, the American founding fathers were rebelling for taxes. They didn't even want to render unto Caesar. I would have to say that the British Tories in the American Revolution had much the better biblical argument. Whatever American conservatives think, the American Revolution is the opposite of the New Testament. You really can see it all over the place, from Neoplatonism to Seneca. There's no question that Neoplatonism, and by way of Stoicism, is precisely the philosophical backdrop for Christianity. I think that's pretty obvious. In fact, Christianity is a sort of an intermediary. Neoplatonism, I think, was the ascending philosophy in the ancient world. Throughout the Hellenistic and Roman periods, there's an increasing appeal of Neoplatonism. So what Christianity did is it became the perfect vehicle by which to transmit Neoplatonism, if you will, for the reasons I indicated earlier. I think Jewish monotheism was always more consistent with it. So all they had to do was throw in the various elements of, say, the pagan man god, fuse that with the Neoplatonism and Stoicism that was so popular in Rome at the time, and it became the perfect vehicle for Neoplatonism. And it carried that Neoplatonism right in through from St. Augustine right into the Dark Ages, which were darkened by that very fact. Christianity was itself really just the religious trappings, if you will, for Neoplatonism to set in. Interestingly enough, by the 13th century, it was also starting to widen its scope through the good graces of St. Thomas Aquinas to include Aristotelian elements. The great genius of Christianity has been its flexibility. And the reason why it survived 2,000 years is that it was able enough to detach itself enough from its Neoplatonic origins to be a livable doctrine eventually. But yes, there's absolutely no question that Christianity, the reason why we should study the history of Christianity is that it was the great vehicle by which Neoplatonic philosophy was transmitted into Western civilization.
And it destroyed them. It destroyed the Roman Empire.
Precisely. The advent of Neoplatonic dualism and mysticism is the direct cause of the fall of the Roman Empire and the commencement of the Dark Ages. I mean, they were dark on purpose. If you look at it this way, the barbarians didn't conquer them at all. The barbarians were conquered by them. Today, Franks and Visigoths, the people who live in France and Spain, are still good Roman Christians, and they still speak a recognizable form of Latin, French or Spanish. Culturally speaking, the barbarians were conquered by the Romans, who had a superior culture. In effect, Christianity survived, as did Roman culture, straight through. It was Christianity that caused the Western Roman Empire to fall apart. Literally, the aristocrats were joining monasteries rather than the army. And Rome, which once had a glorious military culture, right, was finding itself more and more and more in the grip of Platonic dualism and pacifism, making it so that they would have to hire out their military. The West would collapse from within due to Christianity, the Western Roman Empire. And although the Eastern Roman Empire would continue in some form for centuries, what we call the Byzantine Empire, it immediately engaged in what I can only describe as a self-inflicted lobotomy. they, you know, this was an age before the printing press. And so any books that were preserved from the ancient world had to be copied by hand. And so most of the ancient literature of the classical world was lost because they didn't copy it. In fact, they bleached over the vellum and created Christian prayer books or Christian hymn books out of the old copies of, say, Archimedes' Method or Aristotle's dialogues. And that's why they exist only in palimpsest form today. We can only discover, say, an outline of some lost ancient world behind some Byzantine Christian prayer book or hymn book, because the Christians no longer copied the works of Aristotle or Archimedes, and rather just made an umpteenth next copy of some Christian hymn book. And we really lost the knowledge of the classical world much more through that process, the failure to copy and preserve the books, than we did through, say, book burnings. Although there were book burnings, famously. I mean, there were Savonarolas, right, who would in the middle of Florence just burn all the art and books that they could. And there were, of course, times when books were censored. But by and large, the knowledge of the pagan classical world was lost because Christians in the Byzantine world simply refused to copy the works of classical authors. Yeah, there's no question Christianity made the Dark Ages dark, destroyed and lost so much of classical knowledge. We'll never really know how much we don't know about the classical world, thanks to that black hole, if I can describe it, that separates us from the classical world created by Christian culture. I mean, isn't it a tragedy? I mean, Cicero describes the dialogues of Aristotle as liquid gold, even better than Plato's dialogues. And none of them, not a single one of Aristotle's dialogues still exists. Or Archimedes' Method, right? We have to rediscover that in palimpsest form. One of the greatest scientists of the ancient world, right? We really are still just recovering his own science. But people like Archimedes and Aristotle, I guess, weren't important enough to preserve. The scientists from the ancient world weren't important enough for medieval Christians to preserve, so they could have a zillionth copy of another Christian prayer book.
Somewhat of a controversial subject.
Indeed. No, that's the thing. It is, you know, we're always told in polite conversation that there are two subjects to avoid, of course, religion and politics. And of course, my book is where religion and politics sort of collide. And so it is inherently a controversial subject. And before I even start talking about it, I usually have to make sure that I won't get punched in the face.
No, not exactly something to discuss this or indeed any other Christmas.
No, not recommended holiday family discussion material. I actually have a great deal of sympathy, if you will, for certain Christians. And this may be hard for someone in our audience to understand, but I do. Philosophy is a necessary thing for human beings. It's not an optional element. And when we don't have, you know, most of us just don't have the wherewithal to develop a whole philosophy. It's obviously an accumulated effort. I mean, like Newton said, we stand upon the shoulders of giants when we discover something new, any of us. And without a secular rational philosophy as an alternative, religion is a tempting necessity. It gives us a moral framework. It gives us a basic way of putting things together. And if you and I might think that it doesn't adequately answer those questions, metaphysical or ethical questions that need a clear answer, at least it provides an answer. Again, let me go as far as I can in being as sympathetic to Christianity as I can. There are things to be said about Christianity. It did, unlike, say, Islam, carry elements of the classical world into Western civilization in a direct and pure form in a way that Islam did not. I think making the Christian civilization easier to adapt, easier to modernize, if you will, than, say, Islamic culture was. Although the golden age of Islam 1,000 years ago, right, itself had an Aristotelian period of scientific advancement. But I think there were forces within Islam that brought that to a halt that did not exist within the Christian world, precisely because Christianity carried certain elements of classical learning into its own tradition. I'll even go further. they're actually nice elements, the beautiful elements of Christianity, I have to say. For most, you and I are advocates of the philosophy of Ayn Rand, objectivism. And obviously, from our perspective, Christianity is just about the opposite in every way you can imagine. It's metaphysics, it's is dualistic, its epistemology is mystical revelation, its ethics is altruism, its politics is total submission to the state. And so in every fundamental way, the doctrine found in the New Testament is really diametrically opposed to objectivism that you can just about think of. But even Ayn Rand could find things in Christianity that she liked. For example, she loved the wonderful quote, "For what should it profit a man if he should gain the whole world but lose his own soul?" Or the focus on the individual soul, individual salvation, even if it is a mystical thing, it created within Christian culture a sort of an emphasis on reality to the individual, and that individuals were equal in one sense before God. And that could sort of dovetail into an equality before the law in Christian culture. Again, I'm doing my best to find things within Christianity that I can praise, but there definitely are things that made Christianity, if you will, amenable to that kind of benevolent change. No question about it. And they were based on things, ideas that were carried from the classical world into Christianity, straight through into Western civilization. So I have to, you know, tip my hat at least to that extent.
Given that it was aimed at a Jewish audience, to what extent does it preserve Jewish ideas and customs?
Well, that's the other side of this, isn't it? It very much does. You know, what the Romans did not, despite their anti-Semitism, despise everything about the Jews or even the Jewish rebels. There were things about Judaism that Roman society admired, and you can hear it in Roman history as well. So where we see Roman social ethics overlapping with Hebrew social ethics, Hebrew social ethics is featured and promoted and very much advertised in Christianity. For example, take the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. We see forms of that already influencing Stoic philosophers like Seneca. Seneca himself articulates forms of the golden rule, which probably has its roots in Jewish ethical wisdom and of the first century BC. So, of course, it's hardly surprising to see the golden rule actively featured in the New Testament as an ethical doctrine. And that's not all. The Romans were very, very impressed by the commitment, if you will, the Jewish religion to its ethics. And we can see that favorably featured in the New Testament as well. The entire notion of the Messiah itself is, of course, predicated on the Hebrew prophecies. Jesus is an echo of everything that's expected of a Hebrew Messiah in the first century. He is a descendant of King David. He is born in Bethlehem. A star heralds his birth. He is appropriately circumcised. He goes through the baptism ritual that certain first century Jewish extremist groups required, and so forth. It even goes beyond that. The descriptions of Jesus's life in the New Testament are very frequently based upon material in the Hebrew scriptures. That's an astonishing fact in itself. If they're telling us the biography of a recent fellow named Jesus who lived in the first century, why would they be citing material from the Hebrew scriptures? Take, for example, at the nativity of Jesus, we're told that King Herod slaughters all the babies of Bethlehem. Well, that is, of course, an echo of the same story told about the baby Moses. When Moses is born, a Jewish savior has been prophesied. And so what does Pharaoh do? He kills all the Hebrew babies. And that's why Moses is put on the river to be picked up by Pharaoh's daughter. So what we're seeing again and again and again in the New Testament is entire passages from Hebrew scripture simply written into the life of Jesus. When, for example, the archangel Gabriel announces to the Virgin Mary that she's about to give birth to the Messiah, she goes into this speech, which is almost a perfect echo of a similar speech that a woman in Hebrew scripture gives, the mother of the prophet Samuel, when she too has a miraculous birth, this time not a virgin birth, but a birth in her old age. But her miraculous pregnancy, she has this, you know, thank God I'm blessed among all women. That very speech is basically reproduced for Mary in the New Testament. So we can be certain that one of the major sources for the gospel writers was the Old Testament, were Hebrew scriptures, and not, in fact, any recent biographical tradition about a man named Jesus. Many, many elements of Jewish ideas and culture come through that were even sort of not Roman. When Christianity does become popular in the Roman Empire, there are certain Jewish features that were sort of anti-Roman that it brought in as well. The Roman culture was notoriously sexually libertine from a Christian perspective, right? They had a much more open and less uptight view about sex, let's put it that way. Christianity, when it took over the empire, one of the major changes to classical civilization, to Roman civilization that it brought was a much stricter sexual ethic. Now, of course, that's consistent with Neoplatonism in general, right? The sort of disparagement of the physical is the tendency of Neoplatonism. What we see in Christianity, for example, when it says poverty is wonderful and sex is to be avoided, both those doctrines are in the New Testament, right? Paul recommends celibacy. Paul says money is the root of all evil. Jesus recommends becoming a eunuch, whatever that means, for the kingdom of heaven's sake. And he says that you can't serve both a man and a God and money. So this doctrine that wealth and sex are bad is part of Platonic dualism, right? It's sort of the disparagement of the material world itself that becomes inevitable in sort of any sort of mystical dualism. But we find Jewish morality is far more consistent with that. It had a much stricter sexual morality, for example. And so what Christianity does is it combines the stricter Jewish sexual morality, which again dovetails neatly with this Neoplatonic dualism. And that combination creates in Christianity a very anti-sex attitude. And we see it isn't until well into the Middle Ages, though, that all priests are required to be celibate. But we see celibate monks early on in the Christian tradition, a monastic tradition that probably has its roots in a Jewish monastic tradition of separating from the world and being sexually abstemious and so forth, denying the flesh in every form that you can imagine. The early Christian writer, Origen, took Jesus quite literally when Jesus said, become a eunuch for the kingdom of heaven's sake. The early Christian writer, Origen, castrated himself. That's in sharp contrast to traditional Greco-Roman sexual ethics. But we see sort of an extreme form of Neoplatonism dovetailing with Jewish sexual ethics to make this perfect storm of anti-worldly approach to things like money and sex that became very extreme in the Middle Ages. Really today, we've come so far away from that original doctrine since the Enlightenment that the only place where you can see Christianity consistently practiced is maybe in monasteries or Amish communities these days.
Do you think there was a historical Jesus? Do you think we could ever know the answer to this question? I believe your book takes the position that we will never know.
Yes, we do not. That question may never be satisfactorily answered. That may be one of the great unknowns that we just have to live with for the rest of time, because there is no physical evidence and no contemporary documentary evidence for Jesus. The earliest documents that mention him in a theological context, that is to say, the writings of the New Testament. They're talking about a man God, right? And they're not talking so much about a historical being. And by the time Jesus is really talked about in secular history, he's left living memory. And so the very existence of a historical Jesus becomes problematic. And there are excellent arguments that scholars make on both sides. The so-called mythicists, who say there was no Jesus, they point to the fact that there's no element of Jesus that really doesn't have some other cause or reason, whether in Hebrew prophecies or being modeled by some pagan deity. So it either comes from some aspect of a pagan deity or some aspect of Jewish prophecy being fulfilled. But in either sense, the Jesus that we have in the New Testament could be a purely synthetic creation. There are those who are very dissatisfied with that and say, well, wait a minute, you know, doesn't it make better sense that there was at least someone named Jesus that sort of got it all rolling in some sense, and they just, that sort of snowballed, the sort of Jesus movement snowballed. The best arguments, I think, for that are the fact of the crucifixion. The crucifixion is a sort of paradoxical thing. If there was a historical Jesus, we cannot rely on the New Testament as history. Even critical Christian scholars recognize that some 80 or 90% of the material quoted, actually quoted from Jesus in the New Testament, could not have been spoken by any historical Jesus. I'll give you an example. Deny yourself, pick up your own cross, and follow me. Well, no living Jesus could have said that. He's not only magically predicting the method of his own execution, it would have been nonsensical to his listeners. They didn't know about the cross yet, or his crucifixion yet. But and in fact, the statement, pick up your own cross and follow me, speaks to a more metaphorical or abstract understanding of the crucifixion. So that quotation was inserted clearly into the mouth of Jesus at a later date by people who already saw the crucifixion in an abstract and symbolic way. And most of the stuff quoted by Jesus in the New Testament simply could not have been uttered by any historical Jesus. And that has led scholars to say, look, since we can't rely on the New Testament, what can we really know about Jesus? What would be the bare facts that we could possibly know? And the one bare fact maybe we have, since the Gospels are so unreliable, is the fact of his crucifixion. If there's anything that would have been true about him, it was the fact that he would have was crucified. If there was a historical Jesus, that is. Well, if there was a historical Jesus, and if he was crucified, it's far more likely he was crucified for being a rebel. The Romans would not have crucified an advocate of peace. The Romans would not have crucified an advocate of tax, paying your taxes and rendering unto Caesar. Had the Romans known about Jesus, they would have probably hired him as a spokesman rather than crucify him. And so if there was a historical Jesus, let me suggest that he was the exact opposite of the person described in the Gospels. Since we know the earliest Christians were Torah Orthodox, from Paul's own arguments, we know that all the previous Christians were sticklers about the Mosaic Law, and that Paul was the innovator in this regard. And so Jesus would have been Torah Orthodox, and like we know the earliest Christians all were, if there was a historical Jesus at all, Jesus would also have likely have been a political rebel. Again, that's why Paul is arguing so strenuously for peace and paying your taxes, and why he has to stand on his head to say that the Roman government are God's agents on earth and so forth. That, again, that's a Pauline innovation. If there was a historical Jesus, he probably advocated rebellion, which is consistent with Torah orthodoxy, right? And so if there was a historical Jesus, and that is still an F in my mind, he was precisely the opposite of the fellow described in the Gospels. He was Torah Orthodox, a violence advocating rebel who was crucified for that reason. The real Jesus, if there was such a thing, would have been very, very different from the Prince of Peace in the greatest story ever told. That's for sure. He would not have gone around praising centurions and praising centurions as having more faith than any son of Israel would never have gotten the man crucified. And so what we have in the Gospels' passion narrative, the story of Jesus' execution, is sort of an elaborate explanation, right? A sort of elaborate explanation for why a crucifixion might have happened and why this peace advocate would have ever been crucified by Pilate. It requires explanation if there was such a crucifixion, eh? And in fact, it would require the sort of explanation that the Gospels give it. See, if Jesus had been convicted of violating the Mosaic Law by the Sanhedrin, they had all the power in the world to execute him themselves. They routinely executed people without any permission from the Roman government. Josephus, the first century historian, quotes the Roman edicts, which give Jews before the Jewish War the right to execute their own laws, enforce their own laws, including the death penalty. In fact, the Gospels themselves depict scenes in which Jewish authorities are having, say, the Jesus interrupting the stoning of the sinning woman, or the stoning of St. Stephen in the book of Acts. The Sanhedrin convicts St. Stephen of the very same crime Jesus is convicted of, and they don't need Pilate's permission. They just stoned St. Stephen. And so you have to ask yourself, Why, if the Sanhedrin convicted Jesus of those crimes, didn't they just stone him themselves? This is this bizarre explanation that's being given in the narrative. If there was a historical Jesus, they needed to take that extent. They needed to go to that extent to exonerate the Roman government of the crucifixion. Now, if there wasn't a historical Jesus, that's equally explainable. Jesus would have made the perfect vehicle for what? Describing how the Jewish people had created their own problem. Messianic prophecies had also indicated a messianic precursor who might have to be martyred, a human sacrifice that would allow the messianic advent to occur. And within Hebrew prophecy, that's known as the suffering servant. And in that those Jewish prophecies, they say the suffering servant must be pierced for the transgressions of the people. And that perfectly dovetails in with crucifixion. So either in fulfillment of Jewish prophecy, he was crucified to be pierced for the transgressions of the Jewish people, or whether it was actually a man who was crucified, it's hard for me to tell. I think there's good arguments on both sides. But in either case, if there was a historical Jesus, he was exactly the opposite of the person described in the New Testament.
How do you account for the diverse variety of Christian literature and sects in the first three centuries?
That is an outstanding question. In fact, one of the arguments that I would submit for my thesis is the fact that we have four Gospels: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Each of these was addressed to a different segment of the population being aimed at. More Hellenized Jewish population was being addressed in Luke and Acts, whereas a more Orthodox Jewish population was being addressed in the book of Matthew. And still a more Messianic audience is addressed in the book of John. So the various groups within Judaism are clearly each having a form of the Jesus story told to that specific audience. And it strikes me as very odd that all at once, several different Jewish communities are being appealed to with the same essential argument, just given a slight twist for their own community, if that makes sense. And more than that, once that happens, once Christianity has detached itself from the mother faith, Judaism, it can then become all kinds of things. It can add various pagan elements, which it quickly added. The Gnostic movement, which is a sort of a Platonic movement, which affected many religions. Judaism, as well as other ancient religions, could directly affect Christianity and did. Soon, various forms of Christianity cut their ties with the Jewish faith altogether. Marcion of Sinope, Christian bishop in the second century, said, "We don't need the Hebrew scriptures at all." So Gnostic forms of Christianity and far more anti and paganized and Hellenized forms of Christianity developed in the second century, and a wide variety of them did. And what's very interesting is that when Christianity did become the official religion of the Roman Empire in the fourth century, it sort of had to declare many of these variant Christians to be heretical because they were going off on their own and deeply Hellenizing and coming up with all kinds of creative heretical versions of Christianity, what would later be seen as heretical versions, of course, because at the time there was no canonical version of Christianity. And Christianity in the first three centuries was in a period of creative flux. And so we see a wide variety of Christian literature, very creative Christian literature of various kinds, some of which said Jesus was only a spiritual being and never a physical man at all. Others saying he was just a man who later became God. some of which, that, as I say, completely cut off the Jewish tradition altogether. It was only when it became the official doctrine of the Roman Empire that they needed Christianity to be unified and for there to be a single canon of literature and a single doctrine of faith. And thus we see at the Council of Nicaea in the early fourth century, when Christianity is becoming the official faith of the Roman Empire, all the Christian bishops in the empire getting together and saying, okay, let's iron out these differences. Let's resolve the various variations on this theme that we've made and make it a single doctrine. And what we call Trinitarian Christianity, all really Christianity since then, was came to its final form only at the Council of Nicaea, which developed the doctrine of the Trinity and so forth, and sort of ironed out the differences that had emerged in Christianity in the first three centuries. They didn't realize that they were creating such a powerful beast that would gobble up their own empire. They thought they were only pacifying the Jewish rebels, but so successful a formula was it for pacifying their conquered people that it became the ideal means of doing so and unifying the entire empire.
Which books or historical sources would you suggest to anyone who wanted to know more about some of the information presented in your book?
Well, fortunately, I'm not alone. Recent scholarship, I really have to say that I'm just a member of a growing new school of thought in this area of Roman provenance. I am by no means alone, fortunately, in this. And the pioneering work was done back in the 1990s by Professor Robert Eisenman and his work, James, the Brother of Jesus. His other works on the various ideologies of the first century. He is an important translator of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and he is the scholar that got the Huntington Library to release a photostatic copy of their entire set of the Dead Sea Scrolls, because the officials who were in charge of translating and releasing them have been dragging their feet for literally decades. And he got the Dead Sea Scrolls made available to all scholars. And in his own analysis of the Dead Sea Scrolls, he began to see how Messianic Jewish ideology had in effect been turned on its head in the New Testament. He identified it in both an ideological and even a linguistic way at such a level that I can only recommend his work to readers who have a real deep interest in this, because he'll get into some very technical issues, but he makes some very, very powerful arguments. I don't agree with everything, or at least I'll say I don't necessarily agree with everything Professor Eisenman says, because he does say some very controversial things, which we do not rely upon in our own theory. We don't think it's necessary to establish basic Roman provenance. But Robert Eisenman in James, the Brother of Jesus, highly recommended work. I also highly recommend the work of Joseph Atwill, Caesar's Messiah, written in 2005. It, for the first time, began to explore the relationship between the imperial Flavian dynasty of Roman emperors who ruled Rome at the end of the first century, while the Gospels, the very period when the Gospels and most of the New Testament was composed, and Christianity itself, which is a subject we deeply explore in the book. I also recommend the work of Theos Vosculin and Rosemary Sheldon, Operation Messiah, which argues nothing less than that Paul was a Roman intelligence operative. And that book came out in 2008. I recommend as well the work of Francesco Carota, the Italian scholar whose work more than 10 years ago was finally translated from German and Italian into English and is available now to English-speaking audiences. And he has another brilliant analysis where he shows the relationship between the imperial cult, even the imperial cult of the divine Julius Caesar, and early Christianity. And all of those parallels, when taken together, each of them have something important to add to this. And many of their arguments overlap with arguments that we independently discovered. My co-author and I, back in the 1980s, before any of these other authors had published any of their works, before we'd heard of any of these other authors, had stumbled across this theory. And we were absolutely convinced, both of Roman provenance and of Flavian provenance to the New Testament back in the 1980s. And we've been working on it for 30 years. And it's just one of those strange things in the development of knowledge, you know, sort of, I hate to compare it to such a grand thing, like Newton and Leibniz independently discovering calculus, or like Wallace and Darwin independently discovering natural selection. I really feel like this is the moment in history when scholars have finally stumbled across the obvious reality of Roman provenance to the New Testament. Why I compare it to those grander scientific outlooks is there is something in common. Once you see the world from, say, the standpoint of Darwinian evolution, it's impossible to unsee it that way. In other words, once you get evolution, you say, oh my gosh, yeah, fish and lizards and birds all have two eyes, a nose underneath, four appendages sticking out. We're all related. So that the differences and similarities between the various species now has a causal explanation. And when you look at the natural world thereafter, it's impossible to not see Darwin playing out in the natural world. Once you've got that angle, all your observations are now changed. I would modestly or immodestly perhaps compare my own understanding of Christianity to that. Once you look at the New Testament from this angle, suddenly everything becomes obvious. You can't not see it. Just to give you a few examples, Jesus's famous parable, the parable of the Good Samaritan. We all know the parable of the Good Samaritan, which is taught in Sunday schools, all Christians at least. We know the story of the man who was beaten up and robbed and left on the side of the road, and a Jewish priest walks by, and he walks on the other side of the road, ignoring the guy. And a Jewish Levite, a holy man, walks by, and he ignores the man, but a Samaritan happens by, a foreigner, a non-Jew. He picks up the man, takes him home, feeds him, dresses his wounds, cares for him. What's the message of the story? It's the parable of the Good Samaritan. Well, let's just name it what it really is. It's the parable of the good foreigner. It's the parable of the bad Jew. Once you, and there's just one juicy example. Once you understand the theory of Roman provenance and reread the New Testament, then suddenly, literally every single narrative story, every single idea expressed suddenly takes on a new and different meaning. And suddenly it's quite obvious what the original agenda was. And so now I can't look at Christian art. I can't look at read Christian literature without the theory screaming at me. It's very much like a fundamental, you know, reorientation. Once you've seen Christianity in this light, you can't not unsee it in that light. It explains everything. And suddenly, as I say to my Christian friends, well, just drop your finger down at random in the New Testament, and I will explain to you how that's obviously Roman propaganda. It's just a fun test to do. Or take Christian literature for the last 2,000 years. A great example, Dante's Divine Comedy. Dante was a medieval Italian poet, of course, wrote a very famous epic, right, where he takes one through the Christian metaphysical world, right? Through purgatory and hell and then up to paradise. And as we're going to the depths of hell, we're taken down through the various levels of hell by Dante, right? The inferno, where each type of sinner gets an appropriate punishment, right? Adulterers are strapped up by their genitals for all time and so forth. And blasphemers by their tongues and so forth, until you get to worse punishments and worse punishments for worse sinners. The deeper and deeper down into the inferno we go, until we've reached the bottom. Lucifer himself is frozen in a lake at the very bottom, and he's got three faces. And in each of his three mouths, he's chewing the three worst sinners of all time. And of course, as Christians might expect, there's Judas, the disciple who betrayed Jesus. That's easy to understand. But in the other two mouths are the assassins of Julius Caesar, Brutus and Cassius. Suddenly, all of Christian art takes on a whole new look. And suddenly, it's explicable in a way that never really was before. You know, it's maybe my epistemological bias, but it's a bias towards integration, trying to bring everything together in a consistent way. And I think one of the things that's impaired contemporaries from seeing this with great clarity is that modern scientific method is almost the opposite. It tries to break everything down into its smallest, you know, particulate. What it takes to understand this is an ability to put a lot of various things together. And then once you've done it, what it does, like any good scientific understanding does, it majestically simplifies the entire subject. And then you know you're on the right track. But you know, it really doesn't matter whether there was a historical Jesus. A historical Jesus is really one of the least important, least relevant questions in the topic. What matters is Jesus Christ as described in the New Testament. That character has had a monumental influence on history. That being we can talk about. In other words, it's not whether or not we can deduce the Jesus that must have really been, because that's where the direction that biblical scholarship initially took. In the 19th century, the German historians who really invented critical biblical scholarship tried to discover the real Jesus, the real historical Jesus. And so through various deductive processes, they tried to strip away what they thought, what they were discovering was unreliable material, strip that away to get at what Jesus must have really been. And a very smart scholar, about 100 years ago, the famous Albert Schweitzer, the missionary, the doctor in Africa. He was also a biblical critic, a biblical scholar of the First Order. He wrote a book called The Quest for the Historical Jesus, another book I highly recommend, even though he's a Christian. Because what he said is, look, guys, the New Testament presents us with a theological construct. It is impossible to penetrate to the historical Jesus because all we have is this theological construct. He noted, isn't it interesting that everybody seems to, you know, Marxists find a Marxist Jesus, existentialists find an existentialist Jesus. And Albert Schweitzer noted, isn't it funny how the Jesus, the real Jesus, always turns out to be, why, the author himself. And he said, look, there is no real Jesus in that sense, even if there was a real Jesus. We can't pierce that veil, as it were. What we have is the Jesus of the New Testament. And he can be explained. And it is on that basis that we've proceeded to try and understand, not that the New Testament is unreliable, but what is the New Testament? What is it actually doing? What is its agenda? And that can be determined with clarity. The New Testament is both theological and political propaganda. The theological agenda and the political agenda of the New Testament is clear. And that is what shaped Christianity, and that is what shaped Western civilization for the last 2,000 years. That is the important topic we need to understand, not the real Jesus. Because that assumes that, well, when we get to the real Jesus, then we'll get the real deal. I don't necessarily assume that. So the mythicists are the other side of it, you see? By claiming that there is no historical Jesus, they've lost themselves in that quest. Whether or not there's a historical Jesus is entirely beside the point. Let's talk about what Christianity is in its earliest documents. That we can know. And if I do say so myself, what creating Christ does for the very first time is to identify what it is, not what it isn't. What the New Testament was in its original first century context, namely Roman propaganda. Well, I hope you have enough material here to make a sensible podcast or an interesting podcast. And I think it's kind of fun for, you know, you objectivists really don't know the topic and really don't care. And bully for them. I mean, bless their hearts. There really is no need to waste their time understanding some ancient philosophy, which is the very opposite of their own, right? But it is still fun to understand the origins of Christianity. And more than that, it's important if we really want to have an effective response to, right, Christianity as objectivists. And it's a completely untilled field. It really is. The objectivists really do need to understand Christianity as their antipode a lot more clearly. And I hope I've done that. As you know, I'm a student of Dr. Leonard Peikoff's and a great admirer of his dim hypothesis. And along with Leonard Peikoff, I believe that it is philosophical constructs like Christianity, which are much more dangerous than outright nihilism, which I don't think has a long-term appeal, really. And Christianity has such a well-developed cultural and philosophical base that I regard Christianity and what it might become in the future as far more dangerous, say, than your average left-wing nihilist. And I think it's very important for us as objectivists to understand Christianity as a consequence so that we can have an effective response to it.
I think we have outlined pretty much the entire book by now.
Yeah, I think we've covered quite a lot. Yeah, I think we did a really good job of covering the bases. I mean, I could get more into the Flavian stuff, I guess. What we see with the difference between Paul's letters, which are the earliest parts of the New Testament, are Paul's letters, interestingly enough. The Gospels had not yet been composed. The Gospels were only composed during the Flavian dynasty, in the immediate wake of the Jewish war and the destruction of the Jewish temple. We were discussing earlier how Paul's mission for the Romans had in effect backfired and failed miserably. Following the destruction of the temple and following the Jewish war, the Romans could give it another shot. And this time they had a much better crack at it. And the means they chose was specifically to create a method by which Jewish messianics could still be loyal Romans and worship the emperor as other Romans did. In order to pull this off, they had to create a man god, very much like the Roman emperor themselves, right? Himself, a man god. And in the process of doing this, the very Roman generals who conquered the Jews for Nero and who would go on to become Roman emperors, the second dynasty of Roman emperors, because of their success in Judea, used Jewish prophecies themselves for their own political ends. As part of the imperial cult of the Emperor Vespasian and his son, the Emperor Titus, they included in their cult the belief that they, in fact, were the Jewish Messiah of prophecy. It was a critical element of the propaganda, if you will, of these Roman emperors to say that the Jewish people, in rebelling, sort of misunderstood their own prophecy. Had they known the correct interpretation, they would have realized that it had pointed to these Roman rulers who did go on to rule the world after conquering Judea. And so these Roman generals and emperors adopted the mantle of Jewish Messiah for their own. Now, that may seem like an odd paradox because it was this notion of Messiah which had been the rallying cry of the rebels. So here we see the Romans sort of co-opting that very notion for themselves in an effort to pacify the Jewish rebels. So we know that the Romans at this time were using messianic Jewish prophecies against the Jewish rebels. They were using it in their imperial cult. What's interesting is that the New Testament, when looked at again from this new angle, appears to be a prophetic justification for this exact claim of the Flavians. One of the things in the New Testament that has astonished and mystified Christian scholars is a claim, for example, that Jesus makes in the Synoptic Gospels, the first three Gospels, that his glorious second coming will happen within the lifetimes of people listening to him at the moment. In other words, Jesus unequivocally stated that the glorious second coming would occur within the first century. Now, this is an astonishing mistake on Jesus's part. It's almost as if he was the first of these, you know, all these crazy people predicting the end of the world. The apocalypse is nigh, and they'll actually predict the date for the end of the world. Jesus must be accounted as the first Christian to get the date of the second coming wrong. Or was he? Or was there some other purpose to that? Looked at from another angle, the glorious second coming might well have been these emperors, Vespasian and Titus. Looked at from that standpoint, Jesus's prophecy appears to be a justification for those claims made by those Roman emperors, doesn't it? And so when looked at from many other angles, for example, there are several parallels between the life of Jesus and the lives of these Roman emperors. They have a humble origin. Their births and deaths are heralded by stars. And I could go on and on. Activities on the Sea of Galilee, the healing miracles of Vespasian. Vespasian cured the blind and the lame, and he cured them in precisely the same fashion that Jesus is described as healing the blind and the lame in the Gospels. The numerous parallels between the Flavian emperors and the Jesus of the Gospels are far too numerous to be mere accidents. Far, far too numerous to be mere accidents. In fact, they combine the same paradoxical elements in their imperial cult that the Jesus of the Gospels combines in the New Testament. Notice they're man gods, very un-Jewish, very un-monotheistic, yet both the Jesus of the Gospels and the Flavian emperors were messiahs and gods. Moreover, they are advocates of peace. Vespasian built a temple to peace. He minted coins with peace on earth, Pax Orbis Terrarum, printed on them. The very ideas in the New Testament that herald the birth of Jesus, peace on earth, goodwill toward men, that we read in the book of Luke, associated with Jesus, why we read Pax Orbis Terrarum on Roman coins. And nothing could be a more naked example of Roman propaganda than Roman coinage, right? There they have the face of the Roman emperor on it, and there they have these Roman civic ideals, harmonia, concordia, spes, hope, eternus. Pax Orbis Terrarum, peace on earth, goodwill toward men, is on the Roman coins jingling in the pockets of people at the very moment when the Gospels are being written, the Flavian dynasty. Furthermore, the very earliest Christian archaeology, the oldest known Christian site of any kind, the oldest Christian catacombs in Rome are in fact originally the burial site of Vespasian's niece, Domitilla. Saint Domitilla, mind you, venerated as a saint in the Christian tradition. Her husband, a cousin of the Flavians, her own cousin, their own third cousin, I believe, Titus Flavius Clemens, was Saint Clement of Rome, a first century pope, according to early church tradition. And the final zinger, of course, is that a symbol uniquely used by the Emperor Titus, practically alone among all the Roman emperors, was the very symbol that Christians used to first symbolize Jesus in the catacombs, the anchor entwined with a fish. On one side of the coins minted by the Emperor Titus, we see his image. On the other, we see the anchor and fish image, the very same anchor and fish image, which was the single most common symbolic representation of Jesus in the catacombs during the Roman period. So Jesus' symbol is the very same as the unique symbol of this Roman emperor who also claimed to be a Jewish Messiah, the very man who fulfilled Jesus' prophecy in destroying Jerusalem and the temple. All of these connections are far too numerous, far too intimate, and far too important to ignore. It seems quite obvious to me that the Flavians had organized a form of Christianity in the late first century, one that was responsible for the composition of the Gospels and the organization of an official cult. This official cult, of course, lasted well beyond the Flavian dynasty. But then again, Roman emperors, once they were officially deified, became permanent Roman gods, permanent members of the Roman pantheon. We should expect their cults to have long outlived them, and indeed, we have evidence that there was a priesthood of Titus and a priesthood of Vespasian throughout the second century. It seems quite plain to me that there is a deep connection between the imperial cult of the Flavians and Christianity, one that's undeniable. Yeah, it's really fascinating because the parallels are so many. At some point, you begin to think, my God, it's as though Jesus is being modeled on these Roman emperors.
So tell us where people can buy your book.
Oh, Creating Christ, How Roman Emperors Invented Christianity is available through Amazon.com. It's available through BarnesandNoble.com, and it can be ordered at your local bookstore. We have both ebook versions for Kindle, Nook, and other e-readers. We have audiobooks, which is available through audiobooks. We also now have hard and paperback editions. Thank you very much. Had to get that in.
Well, I think that is just about the end of the questions we prepared for you.
Well, thank you very, very much for this opportunity to do this. Really.
Thank you, James. That was an incredibly informative and in-depth coverage of what is an extremely interesting and important topic. Really, it was above and beyond all expectations. Thank you again. So that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks for your very thoughtful and interesting answers, James. We cannot wait to have you back on the show in the hopefully not very distant future. Remember to check out the website and subscribe if you like our podcast, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter to get the updates. You are welcome to send in questions about any of the things talked about in this episode, or about irrational stuff in physics or the philosophy of science in general. Send them in to questions@metaphysicsofphysics.com. Thanks for listening. Please tune in for the next episode and start thinking of some questions. Until then, stay rational.